The raven squawked and took off, flapping up to a tree branch overhead, where it settled and looked down on both of them. He lowered his arm and turned to her again. "Hello, Alexandra," said her father. He smiled. "I have been waiting so very long for this moment."
Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Remedial Magic Podcast. My name is Brady, and as always, I'm joined by my brother Baylor and our good friend Delbert to talk about the book, the fan fiction set in the Harry Potter universe called Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below. How's it going, guys?
Good.
It's certainly going. I'll tell you that much.
Life continues to move along no matter what I seem to do. So it seems crazy that we're already back recording again this week. I think that's because I've been trying to catch up on the podcasts. The episodes of this I haven't listened to since I was on vacation still. So I just finished one today. And so to be recording again feels like it's moving a little bit more quickly. But we are here talking about Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below, the second book in the Alexandra Quick series written by Inverarity. And this week we are discussing chapters 14, 15, and 16 of the second book. This is a return to the book because last week we took a break to interview the author of a different fanfiction called Bagsy Beetlehorn and the Thorned Gauntlet. And I thought that was a really fun episode to record, so I'm excited to do more of that in the future. But we're back to Alex Quick. How does that make you guys feel? Does it feel like returning back to a cozy fireplace in the middle of winter, or does it feel like being forced to stand out in the oppressively hot sun in our town that's not supposed to be hot?
Feels like, to me, like that moment where you've been in Hawaii for 2 weeks and everything's been wonderful and great, and then you return home and you're sad for a minute, but then you realize it's okay here too.
Okay. I wondered where you were going with that, to be honest.
No, I love Alex Quick. It's definitely my favorite fan fiction, but it is really cool to do those one-offs, especially when we get an interview. So, I mean, it's awesome.
It is, and we're looking for more of those one-off type interview thing. So if you have a fan fiction you'd like us to try to reach out to the author of, let us know.
Yeah, and if I may throw out, you know, let us know if you enjoyed the last episode. You know, what did you think about it?
Have you read Bagsy Beetlehorn in the meantime? That would be great to get some feedback. And if you haven't read Bagsy Beetlehorn and you're not going to, that's fine, as long as you continue to hit the like button on every single episode that we post. That's all I really care about. So,
is there a like button?
I don't know if there's podcasting? A like button. I don't know. But we do have like 4 more reviews on Spotify.
That's cool.
Ooh. We're up to like 16 5-star reviews on Spotify, I noticed. That's pretty sweet.
How many non-5-star reviews?
None. We are 5 stars across the board. It's 27 5-star reviews.
Absolutely insane that we don't have millions of viewers with the level of content we put out week by week.
I wonder at what point the podcasting platforms start to promote you. It must have something to do with your review count, right?
Maybe.
Like, when you get to 100 5-star reviews, you get a little boost in the algorithm or something?
I did watch a video on YouTube a couple days ago, and Ludwig Ogren, who is a popular YouTuber, streamer, everything, he made a alternate YouTube channel and did nothing except donate $50 with a link to his only video to another streamer, and it had 9,000 hits before he announced that it was him. So maybe that's what we need to do.
So we need to start donating money
to streamers specifically.
Wow. Well, Delbert, if you fund it, I'm all in.
Leave that on you, Brady.
I don't know if the old podcast account has the standing to do something like that at this point, but It might be worth a shot. Maybe we just make a Twitch account called The Remedial Magic Podcast and we donate like $1 at a time. And then we make a viral YouTube video that says I donated $13 to a streamer on Twitch. And it's just disappointing because it's really like I donated $1 to 13 different people instead.
It'd be a great payoff if we used super exciting music through the first half of the video and then you go to the last half and we gained one review.
At this point, one review is a significant boost percentage-wise, so I'd be happy to take it. But jumping off this this diatribe about reviews, did you guys hear any Harry Potter news this week?
Nothing from me.
I actually did. It was actually announced today that there will be a the first of its kind, an interactive attraction that will bring visitors into J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. And it is called Harry Potter Magic at Play. And that will be in Chicago, and it will include, you will be able to, or it simulates Harry Potter's journey in the Wizarding World with hands-on playing and exploring, including starting out in the Dursley's living room, hopping a boat to Hogwarts, levitating a feather and charms, fending off a swarm of Cornish pixies, practicing Quidditch, and visiting Hagrid's pumpkin patch and the Forbidden Forest. And it's kind of interesting because it's only going to be open between November 11th of this year and May 14th of next year. So definitely might need to take a visit to Chicago in order to do that.
Huh. Well, I had not heard of this at all. So that's pretty exciting. That sounds like a podcast road trip if I've ever heard one.
I mean, I'm game. That sounds like fun.
It sounds cool. Hmm. I'm going to join the waitlist right now as we speak.
It appears that this is not only in Chicago, though. It appears there's going to be another one in Washington, D.C.
I bet it's a traveling...
Yeah, like a circus, but Harry Potter themed.
Yeah. It's like a traveling exhibit. It'll be in Chicago for a while and then somewhere else. But that's really exciting. You know, when I was in Europe, I went to the Harry Potter studio tour. And I absolutely cannot recommend that enough to anybody. That was an incredible experience. And they had a few interactive things. You could, like, for example, you could stand next to a broom and hold your hand over it and say up, and it would rise up to meet your hand and some cool stuff like that. But I could have done for some more interactive stuff. And so that's really interesting and really exciting to hear. I think it's interesting that they're starting it in Chicago, of all places, because most of the U.S.-based Harry Potter stuff, aside from the theme parks, happens in New York City. So, good for Chicago. I think Chicago is a much better visit than New York has ever been. Anyways. All right. We're on the wait list. I just added us to the wait list, so...
Fantastic.
Whenever that pops up, maybe we'll decide to make a trip out there. I haven't heard anything necessarily Harry Potter related this past week, but I did some research looking for another fan fiction just to read in the spare time, and I came across a fan fiction called The Arithmancer, which is set at the same time Harry's going to school. In fact, it starts the summer before he goes to school, but it follows Hermione instead. And instead of making her just a general, I know everything about every subject because I work hard character, instead she's very naturally gifted at mathematics. And from what I've read so far, it's following her journey through learning how to take arithmancy and study the kind of the rules that govern magical spells and then manipulate those and use them to her advantage. And I have to say, of all the fan fictions I've ever read, this one might be the most well-written. And I know that we're reading Alex Quick, which in itself is a very well-written fan fiction, but if I had to choose a fan fiction at this point that sounded like professional writing, that read like professional writing, I would probably go ahead and choose The Arithmancer that I've just started reading this past week. And so I would love to recommend that to both of the two of you, but anybody who's listening as well. It's worth checking out. It's two books, and combined they're longer than the original series. So I don't know what the fatigue level will be like, but it's certainly worth taking a look at.
And what was it called again?
The Arithmancer.
The Arithmancer. Interesting. Well, I will probably be reading that in my free time.
It's worth it, I think. I do think it would sound better if it was called the Arithnomancer, because it's easier to say.
True.
And hear, but it's very, very well done, what I've read so far, and it's from Hermione's perspective, which I like, because you don't get too many fan fictions from her perspective that aren't her and her relationship with Ron Weasley.
Or Draco Malfoy.
Right, or Draco Malfoy, or anybody else. So I think it's absolutely worth checking out if you're interested in finding a different fan fiction to read in your spare time.
Sounds fun. I'm sure we'll do an episode on it.
Hopefully we can get the author in for an interview. But with that being said, we do have a main discussion today. As I said before, we're talking about chapters 14, 15, and 16 of Alexander Quick in the Lands Below. For me, not the most interesting chapters necessarily, but they're setting up something much larger, which I think is really fun. So I think that we should probably get into it. And that means, Delbert, we're going to start with you summarizing the section for us.
Fantastic. This is my favorite job out of anything I could do on the podcast.
Yeah, for sure. It's all of our favorites.
Yeah. So let's begin. We start in chapter 14, which is titled Wizard Dueling. Angelique begins hanging out with Darla a little bit again because she's a big dummy. Not my words, but there they are. Max takes Alex around to dueling practice with Martin and Beatrice, who are the other Stormcrow friends. Anna is also invited but declines instantly. Alex also receives a letter from home stating that not only will she be returning for winter, of course, for Christmas break, but she'll be returning back to their old address where they have rebuilt a new home. During their little meetings, powwows, get-togethers, Max tells Alex that Abraham Thorne isn't evil, he's just an enemy of the Confederation, and blames politics. We then move into chapter 15, which is titled The Dark Side. Alex begins spending more time with Max, Martin, and Beatrice. J-Rock does an end-of-semester exercise. Alex has a confrontation with Larry Albo, which gets pretty heated. And Alex finally clues Anna in to the fact that she has a brother, and his name is Max. On to chapter 16, A Walk in the Woods. Rumors similar to what Anna had feared is that Alex and Max are in a relationship now. So Max decides to out himself to the school newspaper and the greater wizarding world that he and Alex are siblings and he is the son of Abraham Thorne. And then he asks Alex to come into the woods secretly.
Secretly, indeed. And I think before we start talking about this, it's important for us to acknowledge that Baylor, for several episodes, you were concerned about Alex and Max having a possible illicit, inappropriate relationship. And evidently so was every other person at Charmbridge, according to these chapters.
Yeah, it was refreshing hearing that I wasn't the only crazy thinking about that, so...
Everybody thought that, it seems like. All of Alex's friends thought that. Shirtliff was thinking that. I think the only people who didn't think that were the other students from BMI.
Yeah. It also was funny because a lot of their reason that they were worried for Alex was because she came back all bruised and hurt every time because they were dueling and stuff. And they thought that Max was just beating her up.
Yeah, speaking of the dueling, that is kind of where this section begins. It does, of course, begin with the knowledge that 2 weeks ago when I gave Angelique the MVP for standing up to Darla, that was a bit misguided because here she is hanging out with Darla again, as I wrote, like a big old dummy. And Alex isn't pleased about that either. And Why do you guys suppose that Angelique is hanging out with Darla again? Does she just not have any other friends?
I mean, I think she really tied herself in with Darla early on, right? Like, it's your best friend, and we certainly don't hear anything else about Angelique and other people unless it's with Alex's group. And that's infrequent enough that it's probably not considered close friends. So I think she might not have any other real friends.
That's kind of what I thought, yeah. I also think maybe she's easily manipulated. So Darla probably apologized and she was like, oh, it's okay.
I think you're probably onto something with that as well. And on top of that, is Darla not the sketchiest character in this whole story?
I mean, she is the only person to cast a killing curse so far, but she hasn't resorted to Muggle firearms.
She hasn't resorted to Muggle firearms, but she's tried to cast a killing curse. She apparently uses her 12-year-old flirtatious ways to get her away with many boys, not just Martin, but many boys, including lots of the older kids from the Mors Mortis Society as well. I don't know. It's like everything I read about Darla doesn't make me annoyed with her. It just kind of makes me feel gross.
Yeah.
Darla has definitely taken a turn this book for me. I thought she was actually going to be pretty cool in the beginning, and now she's definitely like kind of the person you probably want to stay away from if you're in school. You know what I mean? Like, she's kind of gone off the deep end.
You made her MVP like 3 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
I made her MVP right after.
She is a bizarre character. But that's not really the main point of chapter 14. Really, the main point is that Max and Alex really start to develop their sibling relationship. In fact, at one point in this chapter, it's noted that Alex feels her admiration for Max grow essentially every single day that they're spending time together. And I think that it's interesting how easily she is slipping into the typical younger sibling kind of attitude about Maximilian, right? Like, in her eyes, he can do no wrong at this point. And I think that's, I think it's interesting coming from Alex when I would think that she would possibly believe that every person can do something wrong given what's happened to her so far.
I also think, though, on the other side of that, that Max is honestly being the first person that's honest with her. Like, straight up honest. Because Dean Grimm wasn't. The other Grimm sister, she wasn't really telling everything that Alex wanted to know. Her mother certainly hasn't told her anything. So I think just his openness about everything going on, like his willingness to talk about things that are hushed up in public areas, is nice for her.
I think it's helpful that, you know, he's closer to her age than Ben Journey was, because I think he also told Alex some truths that weren't shared by others. But obviously he ended up trying to kill her. Spoiler alert if you're hopping in the middle of the season here.
Middle of book two joiners?
No, but I definitely related a lot. Like, we see Alex kind of transition into wanting to hang out with her older sibling and his friends versus her own friends. And so I definitely related with that point as well.
At this point, we know that Max has had some contact with his father, right? Does this dueling scene where we see Max easily handle two-on-one situations and then also completely obliterate Alex as well, does this make you think that he's received training outside of his schooling as well? It kind of does for me, you know. Reason being is that him and Martin and Beatrice, who are the three that Alex travels with to go to this dueling practice, this secret against the rules dueling practice, are all trained at the same place at the same level. And Max seems to be not just a little bit better than everybody like you might expect from some students. He appears to be head and shoulders above the rest.
I have a take on this that I can't talk a ton about for Baylor's sake. But we do know that book 6 is titled Alexander Quick and the Wizard War. I think it's more so that Max is prepared or preparing for anything at this point. I think he understands a lot more than even the other Stormcrows or the other J-Rock people how real his life could turn to chaos because of who he is. So I don't necessarily think that he's learning from his father as far as, like, how to duel, but I do think that he's taking it a lot more seriously than the people around him.
What do you think, Baylor? Do you agree with what Delbert's saying? Do you think he's just a prodigy, like a Hermione, but for magical combat rather than studies?
I think I agree with what Delbert's saying. Obviously I don't know as much as he does, but I think that Max would be very intelligent to get training from his father if his father's a very good wizard. Obviously he is the most wanted man in the Confederation, but that is what it is. I also think that because Martin and Beatrice are on the same level in the J-Rock as Max is, I believe. I know Max was demoted or whatever, but that, like, the difference in skill, it was very noticeable. And so it's interesting to me that when they go to the same school, they're in J-Rock together, they all know the same technique, but he's just such a better wizard than they are. There has to be some outside force at play. And I do think, you know, what Delbert's saying goes with kind of a theory that I had the last time we talked about the book two episodes ago, and that was that Abraham Thorne is influencing Max in the background, even if he's saying he's working for the Confederation or whatever.
I just want to add in too, like, I know you're agreeing with me, but I'm going to disagree with you on agreeing with me just to cause some controversy here. But we all grew up playing high school sports. I mean, I'm sure you guys played catch with your dad. I'm sure I played catch with my dad. But we weren't the greatest players in the state who probably also only as far as extra training played catch with their dad. It's not like, what's the kid out of Cheyenne that plays for the Mets?
Brandon Nimmo.
Yeah, I don't think he had an MLB career or MLB ties growing up. I think he was just a talented kid who really put time and effort into it. So I don't necessarily think you have to have that connection. Sure, it can help. There's generational MLB players, generational NFL players that come, you know, father, son, and so on and so forth. But I don't think that has to be how it works.
No, I don't. Yeah, I agree. Don't think so. I don't think so either. I was just saying that Max would be smart to use that connection to, be a better wizard.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think he necessarily has to have outside help. I was really just wondering if that's what you guys take away from that. I mean, it's clear that he's obviously better, and that could be just down to his own dedication, as you're saying, Delbert. And so, regardless, he's a good person for Alex to learn from, right? It seems to me, we don't necessarily know how well he can translate his skill into teaching, but it seems to me that he knows more about stuff that she won't learn at school than anybody else she has access to. And that's good for Alex, I think. Obviously, it's a little scary because she gets a little bit off her rocker sometimes and does some crazy stuff. But at the same time as that, it's good for Alex to have somebody showing her the stuff that she'll probably need to know, considering her involvement with Abraham Thorne and everything that's going on with the Confederation.
What do you mean? You don't trust Alex, the girl who had a death curse thrown at her, found out what it did, and then immediately used it 20 minutes later?
I don't trust Alex for a lot of reasons. That really not being one of them, to be honest.
Yeah, trying to kill the Boggart.
You know. That being said, though, Max isn't just good at dueling, right? He's also apparently an incredibly gifted broom flyer as well. So it's just impossible to think for me otherwise that he is not training himself or being trained by somebody to do something big in the future.
I agree with that because And, you know, I'm using my what little I know about the Harry Potter universe just from J.K. Rowling's books and what I've read in this series and a couple other fan fictions. It seems like everybody follows the trend where the kids are either, like, really smart, like Hermione, or, you know, gifted at other things like Quidditch, whatever. But it seems like everybody's spellcasting ability and dueling ability starts at the same level. Like, the older you are, the better you are at it. And obviously, I mean, in Hermione's case, she practiced probably all the time, you know, whatever. I'm sure that there's gifted wizards and witches out there, but it seems like everyone's relatively around the same level. But then you have Max here, who obviously is steps, you know, far ahead of similar students. So I just think, you know, he's probably gifted at flying and academics and everything, but I completely agree. I think he has to be getting training or training himself or whatever.
Now, as part of this conversation, or as part of this whole dueling club experience, really, Alex does ask Max some questions about their father, and he ends up telling her that their father is not evil. He's just an enemy of the Confederation, which is something that we know. But I think it's an interesting statement, because he also tells Alex that Abraham's not really necessarily a member of the Dark Convention. He just has ties to them because it's like the whole enemy of my enemy is my friend thing. And so he has ties to the Dark Convention because they also don't like the Confederation. But if he's not a bad guy and he's willing to link himself to people who are bad people, what does that really say about his character? You know what I mean?
I will say, upon my first reread at this point, I kind of have the same thought going through my head. And when I hear enemy of the Confederation, but not evil, I just equated him to Sirius Black. Grew up in a pretty unfortunate situation, still had family in that situation, but overall wasn't a bad person. And sure, he was wanted by the Ministry of Magic, but he certainly was not evil.
It's a great comparison, actually. I think that's a really apt comparison. What remains unsolved for me is that in Sirius's case, I don't believe that he was ever willingly associating with dark, quote-unquote, dark wizards. And I, according to what Max is saying here and what we know about Abraham, he's willing to make those relationships to achieve his own ends. And so that feels similar to the whole Grindelwald, Dumbledore, for the greater good thing to me, in that they're not trying to be bad people, but they're willing to do bad stuff to achieve the ultimate goal. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I haven't totally decided myself what that exactly means for Abraham Thorne. Obviously, if you're hanging out with, you know, basically Death Eaters, I guess, in America, obviously you're not around a great crowd. And, you know, like they always told us when we were in school, don't, you know, your friends make you as a person. So I'm sure he's probably an arrogant, selfish person, I would guess. But I've, for, you know, this entire series, I've thought that he's actually the good guy in the scenario. I think the Confederation is the bad guys, and I still kind of think that. I don't know. There's not really been anything that's swayed me one way or the other. I just was saying that for controversy, because that's always a good thing. But I still kind of, I am leaning that way just because that's my inherent nature, is that, you know, he's trying to do what's right. And I don't know. We'll see. I'm excited for the next chapter because of the answers, hopefully.
What do you guys think about somebody whose ultimate goal is to make things better for people, but along the way they make things worse for people? You know what I mean? What does that say? Does that make them, can they still be a good person in that situation? Or is it more like you accept the sacrifice of your reputation in favor of helping people out in the end?
I mean, the issue in history, right, is it's written by the victors. So what determines a good person? If we talk about Adolf Hitler, universally everyone's going to say he's a terrible person. But if you talk about Alexander the Great, everyone's going to say he's a great person. But really, all he did for his 20 years was go around and slaughter people and conquer territory. So, like, did he create a better life for the people around him? Probably not. Did it impact the world to make things better? Maybe. Kind of depends on what you prefer out of the East versus West arguments there. I think it's almost inherent that anybody who's willing to risk anything and, like, put someone's needs aside for somebody else's is going to inherently have some bad stuff tied to them.
The thing is I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah.
I do.
I agree that unfortunately, and I do think it's unfortunate that history is written by the victors, right? And so ultimately, I believe that regardless of Abraham Thorne's intentions, if he's successful, then down the line in history, people would not look at him as a bad person, right? But since we kind of get an inside look at what he's doing now, that's a little bit more foggy, I think.
Yeah. I mean, even if we equate it to the wizarding world, right? Like, we have Grindelwald, we have Voldemort, who are the bad guys, but then we have Dumbledore, who's the good guy. But there's plenty of reasons that Dumbledore is a bad guy by having inaction for years against both of them.
It's a very, very interesting conversation.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good episode. Was Abraham Thorne a good guy? I can't wait for that episode.
Okay.
So the only bad thing that we know that Abraham Thorne has done thus far is attempt to kill the Governor General, correct?
Yeah, he's no worse than Darla.
Right, that and openly associating with wizards who are known as dark wizards as well.
Once again, no worse than Darla.
It's interesting, yeah. Because it's like, you know, go back to Sisters of the House Black. Like, Sirius was just there during Bellatrix's wedding or whatever, around all the dark wizards there. I don't know. I don't always think association is necessarily a bad thing. If he's using it, you know, doing illegal stuff, whatever, for his own gain, but that's one thing. But we haven't really seen that, at least if I'm recalling, you know, the first book and this book up to this point correctly. We don't really know how he's used the Dark Convention.
It's true, and you make a good point by saying that association shouldn't necessarily be like the indicator of guilt, because guilty by association isn't really a fair way to categorize people. And so that adds another layer of complexity to the situation, right? And I'm asking a question that's really pretty tough for us to answer until we know more about what he has done for sure. He's really an enigma, and he exists in the gray area between the good side and the bad side, I think.
Yeah, and just to add to exactly what you said, we can't answer it because we don't know. Honestly, the only information we know about the Dark Convention that we can kind of trust, I think, is that Max tries to make an excuse for Abraham consorting with them. Like, it makes them sound bad.
It's true.
Anything that we've read from the Charmbridge Library, we already know can be incredibly biased because it's controlled by the Confederation. So honestly, Max's opinion is probably the closest as far as info we know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's a fair point.
Well, that and, you know, you can clue it in, at least, you know, in a very general way that the Confederation is the one pushing that Abraham Thorne's associated with the Dark Circle. Or, not Dark Circle, Dark Convention.
And let's not forget, two episodes ago, we were talking about how John Manuelito might have some ties to the Dark Convention. And then I immediately called him just an emo guy, like an emo teenager. Yeah. So, is the Dark Convention evil, or are they just very sad?
That is a conversation we had, right? Part of this is, what is the Dark Convention even actually up to? Because I think we agreed kind of collectively that they seem like a bunch of posers. Like, they're like wannabe dark wizards almost.
Right, like a 12-year-old walks in, interrupts the ritual, and walks out, and you don't do anything
to it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, and also, you know, we don't know what the what dark means. Like, it could just be the Confederation doesn't like what they're doing. You know what I mean? So, it's an interesting topic.
I think it's a really good example of how well the story is fleshed out by Inverarity, frankly, that we can have a 15-minute discussion about it and come out the other side still going, well, there's like 16 layers and reasons why we can't really make this determination right now.
Right.
You know, and the fact that he's keeping that going well into the second book when the theme began like two chapters into the first book is pretty impressive writing, I think.
Yeah, I love it.
Yep.
Moving forward, Alex does continue to spend a great deal of time with Martin and Max and Beatrice. In fact, so much to the detriment of her relationship with Anna once again. Though in this instance, I hope we can all agree that it's Anna being ridiculous and not Alex. Alex isn't communicating, but Anna is acting like the jealous stepchild. You know what I mean? But as a part of this whole conflict with Anna, the J-Rock does this end of semester exercise, which sounds pretty cool. And they use some really interesting magical items like grenades, air quotes grenades, that if they explode on you, cover you with like dandelions and stuff, which I think is really neat. But Anna absolutely loses her freaking mind in this scene. She goes berserk because she gets hit by one of these flower grenades and then gets reprimanded by Shirtlift because she wasn't paying attention or whatever. And I just have to say, I haven't really been annoyed with Anna throughout this series so far. She comes off as a petulant little child in this chapter.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to happen. She's only 12, but I mean, it's a hilarious scene. I will say that.
How is she still complaining about being in the J-Rock when it is her own fault that she's there? And again, she's a 12-year-old child, so I have to put myself in that perspective, and that pretty much explains why she's still complaining. But man, is she whiny in this part of this chapter.
Yeah, it's also funny to me because she kind of explodes, and they've always been so structured, you know, all the entire semester, you know, with discipline and everything else. And they're like, oh, why don't you just let her go? She's having a long week or whatever. It's interesting how they don't want to deal with her.
I think it's probably a combination of this year end or this semester end exercise is supposed to be fun, as well as the fact that they all know that Anna's not going to be in J-Rock when the new semester starts. So it's like, well, is it really worth our time?
Yeah,
to deal exactly. with this, you know, I think that's an interesting little part of this chapter. But really, more importantly, in this chapter, Max asks Alex to meet him outside so that he can show her something in the woods. And when she sneaks out and goes down to meet him, rather than running into Max, she has a confrontation with Larry Albo, a person who hasn't really existed in this book. Not only does she have a confrontation with this dude, he's smoking Muggle cigarettes.
Yeah.
He's such a loser, man.
He's so bad.
He's pretty grimy. Yep.
He's like, you know, what's that book called? The Outsiders?
Maybe.
I don't know. It's got the greasers and
oh.
Pony Boy.
Yeah.
Right. He's like part of the greasers, but the worst type of greaser in my mind.
Okay. I have a different take on him, and this is, it's a stretch, I'll admit that much, but have you guys seen the greatest early 2000s or late 90s movie ever made, Joe Dierte?
Yeah, yep, sure have.
Baylor?
Sure have
Joe,
seen it.
Joe Dierte? Or is it
Joe Dirt?
Joe Dirt.
Yeah.
Yes, Joe Dirt.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So, in that movie, we follow a horrendous person, played by David Spade, going through his life, but we also meet an even more horrendous person and his goons, played by Kid Rock, driving around in a, I think, El Camino with his friends in the back of the truck, just hooting and hollering and everything. That's Larry Albo for me. I think I cast a dude off of The Magicians that's like a great actor and really clean and everything, but now it's Kid Rock.
Sure.
Yeah.
He is such a dirtbag. Like, the cigarette thing is one thing, and I don't know. I guess I feel like maybe we're talking bad about people who smoke cigarettes, but goddamn it, don't smoke cigarettes. That's true. A stupid thing to do. But secondly, he's definitely doing it because he thinks it's cool, right? But he's doing it at night outside of the school where nobody can see him, so what the hell's he getting out of it?
You know what else is cool on top of that? You and your, like, 15-year-old friends hanging out, and a 12-year-old girl alone comes by, so you punk her.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you
either pretend or not pretend. I couldn't really understand.
I believe it's pretend.
To cast Crucio on her, and that's what Larry does to Alex. What? First of all, why?
Yeah.
Never has their relationship been like this. Ever. You know, has he been just holding this animosity for an entire semester, and then when he finally gets written into a chapter, it's like, now's the time. You know? It was very far out of left field.
It was definitely confusing for me. I was...
Maybe it's part of the theme of the book, right? Like, in the first book, there was a theme of adults not listening to Alex, essentially. And in this book, there's a theme of Alex getting hit with unforgivable curse after unforgivable curse. You know? But on a more serious note, this triggers some legitimate PTSD in Alex's mind, right? She freezes up. It's not a cool situation for her whatsoever, even if they were pretending, because she's been through it. And frankly, she's experienced more of Crucio than 99% of the entire Wizard Society will ever experience.
It's an interesting take because obviously in Harry Potter, we never even thought about PTSD being a thing in the Wizarding world. But I can only imagine, you know, with the amount of pain and stuff that some of the spells will put in a, you know, put a person through, that it's probably a pretty prevalent thing. And now that I'm thinking, I would guess maybe that's part of the reason that Neville's parents were in St. Mungo's, maybe. But I guess that's the only thing that I can think of that points to it from the original series.
Well, they, like, lost their mind. I mean, if you think about the things from the original series that some of the people go through, you know damn well that Harry would need to have some serious therapy sessions to get over everything that happened to him, but... Even Ron and Hermione, right? All the Weasley family, they lost one of their most important members. Like, they never address it because it's a children's series at heart, but PTSD and trauma is a very real thing in this universe, and I don't blame Alex whatsoever for getting triggered by this happening, right? For her PTSD showing up here. It's not an indictment of her character whatsoever. It's an indictment of Larry for being such a scumbag.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I completely agree.
Max shows up and saves the day. Kind of. Kind of saves the day. In my notes, I wrote, Max shows up and actually casts Crucio on Larry for being a fuckboy. I don't think that anybody probably deserves to get hit with a spell that's literally the torturing jinx, you know? But if there was ever sweet, sweet revenge, it's that.
Here's my thought, and I'm not defending the use of it, because I agree, they're unforgivable for a reason. But probably from Max's point of view, especially with how Alex reacted, I think he thought that he really did Crucio Alex. At least when he walks up.
I think it's fair. How many people in the Wizarding world are going around and jokingly going, Crucio?
In America, probably too many.
You know what I mean? So Max probably hears one of them say it, Larry or one of the other two that are with him, and thinks, oh, this just got real. I need to get over there.
I also wonder, because I was also confused about that whole exchange. Maybe Larry didn't mean to cast it, but maybe it did have some effect on Alex. And then he surprised himself or something like that.
I was wondering about that too, because... Assuming you do the wand motion correctly and you say the word, how does your wand know that you were kidding? You know what I mean? How does your wand know that you were joking around? And we know that if with the unforgivables, if you don't mean what you say, the severity won't necessarily be as intense as it could be if you mean what you say, if you want to kill or you want to hurt. So I think that's a very apt point, Baylor, that maybe he did accidentally cast it without knowing, and then Max is reacting to that as well.
Yeah.
And then question for you two here that I wanted to bring up too. Max is pissed. He is very upset.
He is.
At what has just happened. How important is his infiltration of the Mors Mortis Society if he just stood there and let Alex take Crucio for a few minutes the first time?
Oh, that is a good question. Considering the reaction now.
Like, you would think that if he really cares this much about Alex and everything, and it's his sister, that he would have jumped in immediately, even if it meant blowing his cover.
That's a good question. It's really a good point that you bring up. I don't know. It's just, I don't understand, and I said this in the last book, but I don't understand the purpose of Larry Abbo's character. His purpose in this scene is really to teach Max a lesson more than anything else, because after Max casts Crucio, Alex ditches him too and goes back to the castle because she's so disgusted with him doing that as well, right? She's obviously of the opinion that even if it happened to her, nobody else deserves that. And that kind of shows Max like, hey, you can't just get away with whatever you want, probably. But for real, what is the point of Larry Abel's character? He's more annoying than Malfoy is in the first few books.
He's the Kid Rock of the Wizarding World.
He definitely was the cause of friction in the first book. I can see that, but this scene is definitely interesting, I guess. It kind of, you know, you guys have said it, came out of left field, and I don't totally get the point of it. I'm not going to lie.
It is. I really think it is to insert a little bit of tension between Alex and Max so that he knows that she's not just some helpless little girl, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. It also for me, shows though, that Max is really good at spells and just beating the hell out of people, because he also just kicked the crap out of Larry as well.
He did also beat him up in the normal fashion as well. He just kicked him in the ribs a whole bunch and stuff. But I agree with you. I think that this scene is probably better served by having Alex and Max practicing dueling and having her get one over on him finally, and him realizing, oh, she's actually got what it takes, rather than him having to save her in a helpless situation. Because if there's anything Alex hasn't been in this series, is helpless, right? She's always been able to handle herself. That being said, Alex goes back to her dorm room. Anna's still pissed off about Alex because she thinks Alex is dating Max and that Max is abusing her. And so Alex tells Anna, we're not dating. He's my brother, dog. Chill out. It's not that way. You know, in those exact words. And
Gandalf comes in this scene, blows off the door, finds Darla Dearborn in the bathroom, and she's
dropping some eaves.
I'm not dropping any eaves, I promise.
Yeah.
But she was.
But yeah, Darla was eavesdropping during this conversation, and that's a big old oopsie.
I love how we find out that she's eavesdropping as well, because Alex just says, Anna, do you think I'm a big bimbo like Darla? And then she makes a noise on the other side of the door.
Yeah.
And a big dumb bimbo.
It is bad that Darla hears this, I think. It definitely compromises whatever Max is trying to do a little bit. Well, maybe it doesn't.
Well, they know.
They
right?
know, right? The Mors Mortis Society knows.
At least the leaders do.
Right. Regardless, this does offer Alex some redemption, because she scares the ever-living hell out of Darla here. Darla might think she's big and bad, but Alex scared her just by, like, standing over top of her and telling her to quit that stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it does give Alex a chance to return to form. After Alex, I guess essentially what happens, aside from Alex scaring Darla and Darla overhearing this, is it sets up the first part of chapter 16, where rumors are just flying through the school about Alex and Max. Everybody is bringing it up.
They're warranted. I mean,
I agree.
It seems like they might have been in a relationship. Even Shurtleff, who I think is probably one of the most competent teachers at the school, has a conversation with Max about it.
We're going to get into this during the MVP segment, but Shurtleff is on her A game here, right? Eventually Max and Anna start talking again. He agrees to apologize to Larry if that's what Alex truly wants. She doesn't make him. She just makes him promise never to do that again. Never to crucio somebody again. But he also tells Alex that Shurtleff had just been dressing him down about being in an extremely inappropriate relationship with a younger student. He's 17, she's 12. It's weird. And Shurtleff picks up on this. And you know what? I'm thrilled to say that she was telling him that that's not cool. Even though she's wrong, at least she's looking out for Alex in that way, right? That's really nice that she is doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple things of note is that first, when Alex says, don't ever do that again, he says, I will defend you in any way that I can. I will take whatever measures necessary to defend you. So
unless
it sounds
we're
like
at a Mors Mortis meeting.
Yeah. It sounds like he might do it again, but probably not. I don't know. Second thing of note is that, I mean, Max has been a little handsy with Alex, so I could see why everyone maybe was like, "Huh, interesting, 17-year-old with a 12-year-old, interesting."
It is. It's like in a way that would seem creepy if you didn't have the full context. You know, he's like rubbing her back and hugging her and stuff. But
yeah,
when you know that they're siblings, that's not weird. You know
Yeah,
it's like normal sibling behavior. So it's not necessarily weird for the reader, but it's understandable why it's weird for everybody else in the whole school. You know, and now that you brought it up, Baylor, I want to come back to this really quick. You just said something about how Max will always protect Alex no matter what. And then, Delbert, you said, except at Mors Mortis meetings. And then earlier you alluded to how important is his mission. I would guess part of Max's instruction from his father is to watch out for Alex and make sure nothing happens to her. What does it say about her father if he says, unless it's going to impede the mission that you're on, then let it happen?
Wild.
Is he on a mission from his father or from the Confederacy?
We don't know, right? But the assumption is that somebody has given him a mission. You know what I mean?
He said the WJD or WDJ.
He did last episode, yeah.
It's just interesting to think about. But regardless, all these rumors are happening. I'm sure it's getting uncomfortable for everybody involved. I can't believe Dean Grimm didn't tell Shurtleff that Max is also a thorn. You know?
Yeah.
But aside from all that, Max solves the problem by just telling the school newspaper in a very snarky way, by essentially claiming that they're fake news, but telling the school newspaper that him and Alex are siblings and they pose for a picture, and that seems to take care of the entirety of the rumor problem that's going on.
Unfortunately. And I mean unfortunately, because I shouldn't make this joke, but Constance and Forbearance are still concerned they're dating.
Are they?
Is that what that means?
They're from the South.
Oh, okay, of course.
All right.
Naturally. Our apologies to anybody who lives in the Ozarks.
Listen, we have a contact from the Ozarks. He's gonna rage at me for this one, but I wanted to say that from the beginning of the episode.
That's pretty funny. Regardless of the situation, you know, the rumors kind of subside. Alex takes her end of semester spawn, which she doesn't really seem to care about. In fact, it says in there that she only cares that she does at least as good as she did the previous time, so that she doesn't have to go back to remedial classes. But notably, the training with Max seems to be paying off, because this time she lasts against Shurtleff, because Shurtleff's test is practical, at least for Alex. And Alex lasts much longer this time. Instead of it being like a 10-second duel, it's about a minute long. And while she doesn't beat Shurtleff, Shurtleff is clearly very impressed by her again. But notably, she says, you know, you're a lot better at attacking than you are defending. And I thought Alex's response was pretty cool, where she said, if you're good at attacking, you don't have to defend.
I don't have it in front of me, but I also liked Shirtlift's response to that of saying, then how do you protect the other people? Yep. Like her friends.
It's pretty good. Their relationship is pretty fun.
I like Shirtlift.
Yeah, I like Shirtlift a lot. And then Alex and Max do finally travel into the woods. This time, Max has Alex send her familiar, Charlie, first. I presume to make sure that nothing like the Larry Albo situation happens again. But they go into the woods. We find out a few things about Blacksburg Majory Institute, like how Max has been crucioed as well, because that's part of the curriculum there, is for everybody to get crucioed. So Blacksburg must be like a military school, right? Because it's the same idea as like a Muggle police officer. Before they can use the taser, they have to go through it so they understand it. Same thing happens at BMI with Max.
But you say that as if it's the same as Muggle police, where it's you have to feel the taser to use the taser. Does that mean BMI students, graduates, are allowed to use Crucio?
That's interesting.
I took it that they were just preparing them for, like, probably what they would be subjected to by the enemy.
I think that's much more likely.
See, and I think if you take it even in a further step, if you equate this to, like, NSA or CIA, then it might just be doing it to not give up information.
Yeah.
Again, I think both of those explanations are more likely than them just being given a license to Crucio people all they
would
want.
Would be interesting.
It is the United States, so you know. You never know. Yeah. I guess the Confederation, whatever, but
after the Muggles sold Guantanamo to the wizards.
So that is important information, I assume, for going down the road. But more importantly, this chapter and this section ends with Alex entering a clearing to find her father finally making a legit in-person appearance in this story.
Let's go.
And that's kind of where it ends. Very excited for the next chapter,
insane,
to be honest. Because
finally,
Abraham Thorne has been a mystery the whole time, and we're going to finally get to know him a little bit.
That's the hope.
We had to go through
sure.
28 chapters last book to just see his bird.
We did, yeah. He's so interesting, in fact, that in this episode, we talked for 30 minutes about whether or not he's a good or a bad person, and we have no idea still.
No.
You know what I mean?
Not a chance.
Right. So here's my question with the scene. So the first time that Max asks Alex to come out at night, he says, meet me at the Quidditch pitch. So do you assume that Max was going to take Alex from the Quidditch pitch into the woods probably to see Abraham Thorne the first time?
Yeah, I almost think he was there the first night as well. And Max went back out and was like, look, she's not coming tonight, and said, give me one more night. And he agreed.
I think something like that occurred as well. Yeah. Or put your tinfoil hats on.
Okay.
He was there and he imperiously Larry to Crucio Alex to see what she was made of.
That's sick. Like, actually, like, disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's tinfoil hat, though. That's pretty good.
Hey, we don't know if he's good or bad. We know he's rumored to have met with Voldemort, so I wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah. What do you think, Baylor?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty interesting allegation, I would say. I mean, based on kind of what we're seeing, if Max was in the Mors Mortis Society because Abraham Thorne said, you know, be in the Mors Mortis Society, and he didn't defend her because he was worried it would affect the mission, then I could see that being the case, just, you know, like him proving, kind of like Alex proving her worth, I guess, against Larry. I don't think that she would have passed because she didn't really do anything to Larry. I personally don't think so, but I mean, yeah, that would be pretty crazy.
I just realized this goes even darker. Like, I got to take it a step further from what you just said.
We're going to have a whole episode about conspiracy theories.
Probably. You're telling me that Maximilian walks up and says, hey, you want to meet your daughter? And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll meet you at the Quidditch pitch. And he shows up and says, man, that daughter of yours, she went through 6 minutes of Cruciatus Curse by the Mors Mortis Society. And he was just like, ooh, really? I want to see.
Wow.
We can certainly hope not. I guess we'll table this discussion for a future episode about conspiracy theories. But that is where this section of chapters ends, with Abraham Thorne finally making an appearance. And that means it's time to name the MVP of this arc. Baylor, why don't you start? And then we'll go to you, Delbert.
All right. So the first book's namesake, I went ahead and went with Abraham Thorne because I thought his entrance into the meadow there, I thought it was pretty badass. I will say, though, that if he did somehow and was involved in the Larry Albo scenario, I'm going to be a little upset that I picked him as the MVP.
Oh, man.
I was at work today. I was walking around the parking lot giving out citations, and I was thinking to myself that I wasn't going to pick Abraham Thorne, but somebody certainly was going to. I have a feeling anytime he shows up, he's a front runner for the MVP.
Yeah, that's fair.
Delbert, who did you choose?
I have a very controversial choice here. I was, and it's in the notes, I was going to go Maximilian King. However, what is it, gentlemen, that we care about in our MVPs? It's all about building the character. It's all about becoming more mature. It's all about coming of age, right? Like, these are the kinds of things we're looking for in our MVP.
I am not pleased to hear where this is going.
So, my MVP for this set of chapters, and please give me some rope here, is me.
Oh, whoa. That is not at all what I was expecting.
Did you say you?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Now, here's why. I wanted to show some personal character growth, because about halfway through this discussion, we argued about Angelique being a big dumb dummy head and being friends with Darla. We talked about how she doesn't have friends. We talked about how she probably doesn't have very many people to rely on. And by God, I'm going to show some character growth here and turn fully against the Jarvi, who probably put her down enough to make her have to have a friend in Darla.
Oh,
wow.
So
very nice.
For me, turning against the Jarvi, my favorite magical creature of all time, because it really is probably impacting Angelique negatively, I'm the MVP.
Wow, I never sure. knew. I never knew empathy was in your heart there, Delbert.
Yeah, you know what? Sure. I'm so into
now,
it.
Now the official podcast stance is that we hate the Jarvi.
I don't like the Jarvi. Yes.
Yeah, the official stance. Oh, that's so good to say. I love that. I love that. As for me, I've already given my reasons why, but I picked Shirtliff, and it's because, you know, when there's suspected pedophilia going on, you gotta report it. And Shirtliff, she sure stepped in front of that one. So, big time approve of her, and also I like the way she tests her students, at least Alex. I don't know if she does that for her other students, but I like the way she tests Alex because it's not traditional and it lets Alex show her strengths. So I picked Shirtliff, and so there you go. We have two MVPs from the book and one MVP not, and you know what? The explanation you gave, Delbert, you convinced me. If I could choose you, I would. We do need to name the arc as well. I guess we'll just go in reverse order. I would name this arc the Rumor Mill, because there was rumors of flying and it made me uncomfortable.
Fair.
I'm going to have to defer to our sister podcast or cousin podcast or maybe third cousin podcast of the Fast Five.
Yeah.
To call this family.
Okay, very good. You know, actually, that is a good name.
I like it. It because is. It's like all about protecting the little sister, finally meeting the father.
Yeah.
I liked it.
That's strong. Yeah. I like that. Baylor?
I struggled with this one pretty bad, so I probably didn't win. But I went with the Thorne family reunion because they, Alex and Max don't have to be in the shadows anymore, and we finally meet the father face to face.
Also good for the same reasons.
Once again, my title comes in a distant third place. So, there you go. I don't know what we'll call this episode between those two. They're both good, so.
If we can get Vin Diesel to voice it, we could definitely do family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll figure that out on the back end, but that's it. No casting this week.
No casting.
Maybe next week, but that leaves us just to your prediction, Baylor. And so, first, this is how we do this. Why don't you remind us of your prediction from the last episode about Alex Quick and the Lands Below so we can give it a grade.
Okay, so for my prediction, obviously the clear antagonist of the book, Darla, will spar once more with Alex with intentions to kill. Unfortunately, Alex will panic and recall a spell that worked really well in subduing her, Crucio, and she will cast that on Darla in defense. Also, unfortunately, one of the school's authorities, most likely Shirtliff, I'm guessing, because she seems to be everywhere, will see this, and Alex will get in some serious trouble. Then, big bro Max walks her in the woods and tells her, one, don't do stuff like that, bro, and two, here's the plan for my mission.
Not great.
A two.
Yeah.
It's a two.
He walked her in the woods.
That's the only reason I didn't give this a one. It's a two.
It's unfortunate.
How you could have possibly seen the Larry Albo thing coming, I don't know. How you could have possibly seen hundreds of people talking about the illicit relationship between Alex and Max, I don't know. But, you know, we're grading the prediction and not the difficulty of making the prediction. It's a two.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Deborah's also giving it a two. Okay, that's fine.
That was a hell of a prediction, though.
It was. I liked it. Flavorful. It was a
great prediction.
Yeah.
Just almost totally wrong.
Just about.
Let's hope you can do better with your prediction for the next section of chapters we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about chapters 17 and 18. Chapter 17 is titled Abraham Thorne. Frankly, I think that's a massive hint. And chapter 18 is titled Leave That World Behind, which could be misleading, but let's see what kind of questions you're going to ask first.
Yeah, so I thought at length about these. I definitely didn't think of them right before we recorded. Brady, I will ask you, because you left off with that chapter, what world is Alex leaving behind?
Alex is not leaving behind anything. Instead, you should focus on Claudia.
Okay. That's interesting. That's definitely a turn I didn't see. Delbert, since you're the king of giving non-answers, does Alex get some answers from Abraham finally?
She does get some, but she leaves with even more questions.
As per Abraham's style, I like it. Okay. Let me think on this for a minute. Okay, so I think the first thing Abraham Thorne will do, maybe I shouldn't say the first thing, one of the things that Abraham Thorne will do in this conversation is that he will clue Alex in on Max's mission that he has given him. Obviously, Max has this mission from the WJD, but I think Abraham Thorne has sent him on a mission as well. Alex will ask and get answers about Claudia and the Thorne Circle. And then in other news, in the next chapter, because I just remembered it will be Christmas break, most likely, Alex will tell Claudia about Abraham Thorne, and that will trigger the recessed memories, and she will begin to remember the things that were obliterated by Diana Grimm.
All right.
Interesting.
A little bit simpler this time.
I have a long-term prediction request, or maybe short-term. Maybe we'll find out next chapter. Okay. Is Abraham Thorne a good guy?
Back on this, huh? I'll just go with what I've said the entire last book and this book. I think that he's the good guy in this scenario.
Okay, so he's better than the Confederation is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
Cool.
All right. I guess we'll find out how your prediction fares next week. I can just tell you right now that it's better than what you did this week.
Couldn't be much worse.
So, you guys have anything else you want to talk about?
I do. I want to give a shout out to someone. Longtime listener. Longtime speaker. Mr. Brady. For finishing a year-long D&D campaign that he set for all of us. Me, Baylor, and a couple of our friends that has finally concluded last week.
Yeah, that was lit.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bravo, bravo.
It was an incredibly fun time, and I am so excited to hand the DM reins over to you, Delbert, so that I can sit on the couch and pay no attention.
If you're talking about how I played, I'm not offended whatsoever, because that was kind of true sometimes.
No, D&D is freaking awesome.
Yeah, if you like D&D, or if you haven't liked D&D before and want to try it, check out Curse of Strahd. It is really cool.
Yeah.
Great game.
I would like to give out a shout out as well to a longtime listener as well. Delbert, shout out to you for putting together what I've heard from the sources are 100+ hour long homebrewed campaign for D&D that we will be starting tonight. So bravo to you as well.
Listen, I try to stay humble. You guys all know that. I'm definitely a very humble person. But if you ever say 100 hours again, I will drive up to where you live and put you in the dirt.
I said 100 plus.
I've put 800 plus in so far.
Oh my gosh, okay.
Well, it's a problem.
So it'll be the never-ending session, or never-ending campaign. Sounds good.
Technically, I guess, for this part of the campaign, like, that you could technically stop after, it's probably about 200 hours. But if you play onto the further sections, then it's going to be a lot more.
I'm very excited.
It's going to be fun. We start in about an hour.
We do, yeah.
We do.
Just so that you're not left out, Baylor, shout out to you for surviving the first 25 years of your life.
Thank you. Thank you. It was,
it was
a challenge. Since you just turned 25.
I forgot it was a birthday.
You just had your star birthday, actually.
I did. Please, nobody steal
very
my identity
exciting stuff.
Knowing my date of birth now. Thank you.
I have one last question for both of you.
Okay.
And it's dumb. But if we were to cross the MCU with the Wizarding World, is there anyone from Alex Quick or from Harry Potter that could lift Mjolnir?
Dear Lord. What a question. That's tough, because J.K. Rowling is very good at writing characters who are morally gray.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say Hagrid. That's my best guess.
Hagrid?
Yeah, both because he has giant strength and also because he's one of the only characters who doesn't do something questionable to get ahead.
Kind of bullies Dudley a little bit.
Oh, he does bully Dudley. Yeah, but Captain America literally kills things and he still can. So
I think that Luna Lovegood would do that. Would do good.
Oh. No.
Luna was on my list.
That's an incredible answer.
Yeah. I think that would be a solid answer. My answer, that I don't like this character as much as everyone else, but I do think he's probably the most good of anyone. Dobby the House Elf?
Sure. Yeah, probably. That's a good answer, too.
Yeah.
Both of you said somebody I hadn't considered, and yeah. I think both your answers are really good.
Well, fun little question I wanted to ask before we left.
A fun question, for real. I like that.
Right.
If you have if you have an opinion about that, write in. if you don't have an opinion about that, Write in anyways. Do your part.
Yeah, write in and say you don't have an opinion.
Please. Exactly. With that being said, my dogs are barking. We're going to end the podcast now so that we can get ready for D&D. We'll be back next week with Chapter 17 and 18 of Alexander Quick and the Lands Below. As always, I've been Brady.
I've been Delbert.
I've been Baylor.
And we'll see you next Sunday.
MVP. MVP.
Good night.
Bye.